Today is Wednesday, the 12th of February, 2025. I am privileged to be speaking to Pam Turner in Hastings. Pam, shall we begin by you telling us your life story and story of your family?
Thank you. I am Pamela Mary Turner. My maiden name was Lewis. The fact that my descendants that I'm going to talk about were also Turners is quite coincidental, because we were not related until I married a Turner, which makes recording quite difficult. Anyway, I was born on the 24th of January 1940 in Levin. How I came to be born in Levin is a story in itself, because my parents lived at Pukatitri, which was then a very isolated, mainly forestry area northwest of Napier in Hawke's Bay. Soon after my parents were married, a little boy arrived. And because of very major gynecological problems, my mother was then told that she would never have any more children. So Peter became the cherished heir to the throne. My father then was working in the McLeod and Gardner's Mill at Pukatitri, and also running the farm, which my great-grandfather had carved out of bush and tussock to fulfill his ambition of owning his own land. My great-grandfather was born in Little Driffield in England in March of 1856, and by devious means he came to New Zealand as a nine-year-old boy with his parents. They settled in Maunganui in Northland with the promises of having rich farming land at their feet. But that was a very unreal promise. They then moved down to Thames for the gold mining that was just being developed there, and finally ended up at Turner's Hill, which is about halfway between Pararoa and the Krangahake Gorge. When my great-grandfather, whose name was John Frost Turner, lost his job as a butcher's apprentice when he cut his hand, put a sack over his horse, gathered up his dog, he had £1 in his pocket, and he waved his mum and dad goodbye. He was then 18 years old, and he said, "I'm going to find a farm." He set off down the coast and eventually ended up at Te Pahui, where he was farming, shepherding, cattle mustering, eking out a survival, and he married a Norwegian lady, Galati Tarani Halvorsen. With the records at that time, a lot of the names were just spelt as they sounded, and there are lots of variation spellings for these names, especially for the Norwegian side of the family. John Frost Turner, my great-great-grandfather, had been married 3 and a bit years before the letter that he wrote to his parents telling them he was getting married arrived to the parents. It was 33 years before he actually even got back to see his parents again, and they were then able to meet their daughter-in-law. They settled in a little cottage at Te Pahui, where Galati was the cook, often cooking for 30 people or more over an open fireplace in a little wee soil-floored hut. How she kept all her long robes and gowns and corsets clean and dry and ironed while she was labouring to the level that she was is just an absolute mystery. But I do still have the original letters that John Frost sent to his parents, many of them taking over a year to even reach the parents. So that is how my great-grandparents started life. Sadly, at that stage, they lost their first little baby just a few days before Christmas, which must have been an horrific experience for them. John Frost Turner used to ride across the back country from Te Pahui to Pukatitri, which was then largely undeveloped, but he secured work there with the shepherds and the landowners and built up a good relationship with them for his skills in general farm work, his caring for sheep, his horsemanship, his general work ability when he lost the farm that he was a tenant farmer on at Te Pahui, not his fault, but through the landlord claiming too much in the way of rent, he abandoned everything and took the family by cart to where his wife's sister was established in Napier. That was no mean journey with his wife and new little baby on this cart to come from Te Pahui. It took them 2 days to get to Napier. The cart was pulled by bullocks. He had a horse which he tied to the back of the carriage, and occasionally he would ride it. But otherwise he walked on the cobbly stone road, fended off the less than scrupulous locals as he passed. He put sack cloth around the feet of the dogs so that their little paws wouldn't get too badly hurt on the shingle. And that's how the dusty little family arrived in Napier. He had his three chooks in a little cage on the cart as well. Somewhere they camped over on the road. He then worked his way northwest along the Apley Road to what is now known as the Apley Station. And he would ride home on a Friday night to see his wife and little girl in Napier. And often when he got off the horse after a week's hard work on the farm, he would have to ease himself and get his trousers, which would be stuck to him with blood from his hemorrhoids. That's just some of the hardship that that family faced. Anyway, he worked his way into the hills, and because of the relationship he had with the landowners and the locals around the area, he gradually worked further northwest until he came to Pātoka Station, which is still in existence. He was working there and also worked at the Hawkston Station and built the iron quarry out on the Kawaka Flats. From Pātoka Station, he somehow obtained a block of land right opposite Ball's clearing at Puketitri. Ball's clearing as such did not exist in those days. It was simply 20,000 acres of solid podocarp forest. He pitched, built, strung up a tent system over in the trees by the creek. His wife shifted up with him, by which time they had two little children under three, and made a home in the tents under the bush for about 3 years. He fenced the tent complex to keep the wild animals off and to keep the children safe. Imagine what it would be like so near to the water, which they needed for domestic duties and for the washing of clothes, right beside the creek bank with two little children running and scampering around everywhere. He got work in the district as he could. Times were very, very hard. He bought his own bullocks and built up a team of 18 bullocks, and he became the official carrier from Puketitri down the back road through Hawkston and Dartmoor to Puketapu. This return trip used to take him 4 days. He was carting all sorts of things on the bullock wagon, timber and all sorts of goods back to the locals. He was at that stage the first white settler in Puketitri. As the district developed because of the milling, often part of his cartage would be the odd barrel of whiskey. While he was doing all this, he assisted Mr. Hughes to carve out the now existing Puketitri Road on what is called the swamp cutting, using a pick, a shovel, and a wheelbarrow. And the older maps still show this section of the road as being called the Turner Hughes Road. Somehow he also found time to start farming. He had a flock of 9 sheep. He put a little bell on the oldest sheep so that it would lead the others, and he could hear the bell tinkling so he knew where they were in all the bush and fern. There was no cultivated paddocks whatsoever. This little sheep became very cunning and knew that if it stood still in the bushes, the dogs would go past it and it would be able to stay free. He also had bells on his cows, but the cows were never quite wise enough to stand still, and he could always hear the cowbell tinkling in the bush, and that's how he found them. He built the house, which I grew up in. He pit-sawed timber, hewed it all out with an adze, and built the house from that. He chogged up the cracks between the boards with a mixture of clay and water to chog up the gaps for the drafts, and he used newspaper as wallpaper to line the walls. That was my very first memory of the drafts coming through the chinks as the builder's clay shrank, and little ripples would run along underneath the newspaper. I turned these little ripples into all sorts of little fairies, had them named, and traced them as they ran across the walls as the draft got under the wallpaper. It was particularly noticeable around the open fireplace. This house was very tiny, but we all survived in it. We all thrived in it. It was a wonderful accomplishment for him to come from nothing. He had had a maximum of 3 years of school work, study, before they left England. And when they came to New Zealand, there was just no more schoolwork. It was just work, work, work. So he ran a business of cartage, built the house, and reared his family, starting from, you might say, nothing. But getting back to my origins, Mum had been told that she'd never have another child after my older brother Peter Graham Lewis was born in 1935. Anyway, 4 years later, along came another little boy, David John, and he proved an absolute wonderful asset and blessing to everybody. David was very even-tempered, tolerant, and a born farmer. Not a scholar, but a born farmer. So the two boys were the family, but Mum was very unwell. She never had good health. She'd always been a undernourished, sad little girl, and she never had good health at all in her life. And she was very unwell when David was 7 months old and went to the doctor. With the news that the doctor gave her, Mum walked along the street and sat on a rock in Clive Square in Napier and cried, the news being that she was pregnant. To have a third child under their impoverished conditions was really the last straw. So that was my entry into the world. She was, as I said, not well at all. And her sister, Edith Fiegler, who lived in Levin by then, with her husband, he was a Swiss boy who had jumped ship. She was my mother's elder sister. But she herself was not well. Her husband was never in employment. He could never hold a job because of his personality. He was a good worker, but he just rubbed the boss up the wrong way every time. And so Mum, with my brother David, who was then 7 months old, moved into their family in Levin to look after her elder sister and her two school-age, very young children. Subsequently, I was born in Levin on the 24th of January, just a week before my brother turned a year old. Stayed with her for 6 months. Meanwhile, Dad was busy at the house at Pukatitri, working in the mill, trying to get the farm started with his mother, and built a wash house onto the house, which turned out to be a wonderful asset for my mother, because before that, she had been hand washing all the clothes with a concrete tub and an outside copper under the pine trees. So she came home to this beautiful, beautiful room, just a simple lean-to add to the house, which contained the two concrete tubs and the copper and the bath. So this was just wonderful for her to come home to. I was 6 months old, and the afternoon she arrived in Pukatitri, Dad had borrowed a car to go to Napier and pick her up from the service car. The snow was so deep, there was just the top few inches of the posts standing up above the snow. You could see the first two wires on the fence line. So that was my introduction as a baby to Pukatitri, by which time my older brother Peter was five, and Mum thought, well, gosh, we've got to do something about his schooling. Dad was a very bright student, but was so occupied with farm activities and work and trying to keep the place going that he sort of bypassed the schooling side of things. But Mum got Peter established with the correspondence school. And Peter was a very, very bright boy, too bright for his own benefit, really. He would have excelled and could have excelled at school, but he diddled away his time and didn't achieve a great deal. He wouldn't do the work regularly. He wouldn't sit long enough at the table to do his work. Probably in modern times, he would have been described as being ADHD, but such a thing was never even dreamed of, let alone diagnosed in those days. But Peter never developed anything in the way of social skills, and he would not settle with his schoolwork. He would not do it. I think he was 19. He went to the boys' high school and sat school certificate, which in itself was quite an ordeal. He did pass, but only scraped through, and he never really achieved his full potential in life. Anyway, going back to where I was, which was the start of my life, Dad had built on this wash house, which meant that she wasn't washing out in all weathers, but she still had to carry the clothes in a basket on her hip, probably 100 metres or more out to the long clothesline, out on what we called the flat. Sometimes she'd have to put 4 or 5 pegs in to even hold the washing on the line, the wind was so strong. Great-grandfather had called the farm Whistle Hill. This may have been because the northwesterly wind really did whistle over the hills, or it may have been because of a beautiful little purply flower which grew in the sandy places on the farm, which was known as a whistle flower. It's shaped like a whistle. So that's how the farm got its name of Whistle Hill anyway, and we still carry on with that name in our family trust. So there's Mum, still in bad health, with a little 6-month-old baby, a little boy, just 18 months old, and a very unruly 5-year-old trying to get him to do his schoolwork. The godsend to the family then was my grandmother, Dad's mother. She had had her own problems in life, heartaches, heartbreaks, and was a survivor like her parents. She had come back to look after her father with my father, who, for all intents and purposes, I have since found out, was an illegitimate child. But she faced all odds, disadvantages, and hardships, and reared Dad to the very best of her ability, which in those days could not have been easy because most girls just went away to look after an aunt or something while they had their pregnancy and left the baby for adoption. But Granny was a wonderful person. She was completely non-judgmental, completely non-critical, always there to patch up a grazed knee, to cook a wonderful meal, or quietly be in the background, never interfering, never saying anything. It wasn't until I started doing family research that I even found out that Dad was illegitimate. I have since been able to find his birth father, which is one of 3 sons. We can't finally decide which son, but we pretty well know for sure by circumstances who was Dad's father. And through DNA, I've now found this person who is my first half-cousin. So that's opened whole new channels of everything. I found this out when I had almost finished writing my book on the Pukatitri Pioneer. So our life ticked by. Galati was 12 years older than my great-grandfather, and to have had 3 children at her age and stage was pretty remarkable. She never learnt to write or read English, but she learnt to speak it with quite a guttural dialect. So I grew up in Pukatitri in Hawke's Bay. We lived in this wooden house that great-granddad had hewn from the local bush. The long drop toilet was a story in itself. John Frost Turner had a very great friend, John Whittle, and they used to do a lot of the work together, help each other. And when they met, their conversation was always the same. They were both called John, and like gentlemen, they always shook hands. Hello, John. Hello, John. How are you, John? How are you, John? Did yours go? Yes, mine went. They judged the strength of the storm by whether the long drop toilet had blown over or not. And they would decide that, yes, yours had gone, so it was a pretty good storm then, eh, John? And that was always their meeting conversation. The house was small. There was only 2 bedrooms. The sitting room, which was my bedroom and my parents' bedroom, and I shared it with my brother David. So the 4 of us slept in the one room, which was officially the sitting room. But life revolved around the kitchen, which had a great big wood-burning stove, a sink bench, which was never connected to running water, and big long table down the middle with a form on one side and a big long couch on the other side, and you could get 20 people around that table, no trouble. And so it was a blessing that Mum had my granny to help her with the everyday running of the house. Most of her life, my granny had been a professional cook, mainly in boarding establishments and hotels. And she used to cook us the most fantastic hot meals every day. Breakfast was always much the same, porridge, no oatmeal and cereal and stuff in those days. But dinner was always midday. That was a pot meal of meat and vegetables. And the same with tea at night. That was always a hot meal of meat and vegetables. and Minnie did most of this cooking, which freed Mum up to do other housework, even things like the washing. Modern kids nowadays think that they're hard done by if they've got to do two loads of washing and all they do is put it in and press a few switches. But the copper had to be boiled, which meant that you had to cut in wood the right size to fit in the wood box, boil the copper, and then put the clothes into the copper, stir them around and get them boiling. Everything had to be boiled. And then you'd ladle them out of the copper with a wooden pot stick into the tub where they would be rinsed and then wrung by hand, rinsed again in blue water to make them crisp and clean and white again, and then hand wrung and carried out to the clothesline. So doing these jobs took a lot longer than what they do nowadays. Minnie did have her own bedroom at the end of the house, which also had an open fireplace in it for warmth. Minnie was Dad's mother. Throughout, there's been a lot of contradiction about her name. She was, of course, born as Minnie Priscilla Turner. But somehow along the way, the Priscilla got changed quite a few times. When she was appearing on one of the census rolls for Pukitap, her middle name was Penelope. And when she died, her death certificate showed her name as Pamela. It was after her that I got my name of Pamela. And there was a lot of conflict with my name for a start. I grew up believing that I had two L's in my name because my parents often would refer to me as Pamela, not Pamela, Pamela. And this happened, I think, because of discrepancies in the recording of Minnie's name. Minnie was a little bit sly in that she faked her departure from Hawke's Bay to go to Marton, where my father was born. And she even sent her dad a letter saying that she had married. That person did exist, but as far as I can tell, there was no relationship there. And my great-grandfather may never have known that his one and only grandson was an illegitimate child. It has caused a lot of research to find all this out, but I now know that the person she said was my father's father is not so. Unfortunately, this name did get into print when my auntie, my mother's second sister, wrote up a little bit on their side of the family. Mum and Dad, I should have said, were second cousins, and that's how they met and how the relationship formed. But the person that my auntie mentioned in her unprinted book was definitely not my father's father. And so our lives developed and grew. There was probably so little in my life at that stage that I can remember right back as a two-year-old. Mum and Dad were out haymaking with David and Peter with them, and I was put to bed to have an afternoon sleep after dinner with my granny there to keep an eye on me. When I woke up, she dressed me in blue overalls and I had a big glass bottle full of water tucked under my arm. And she sent me out from the house, remembering I was 2 years old. And I walked out across the flat, down across a hill, across the two board crossing on the creek, through two fences. I talked to the birds as I went. And eventually found my way to the hay paddock where Mum and Dad were working and joined the haymaking party. Also as a two-year-old was when I first got my interest in birds, which has become a lifelong unpaid occupation for me. Mum had taken me across the Bushy Park farm to visit Mrs. Whittle. Mum and Mrs. Whittle were great companions, farmers' wives together, and I suppose they saw each other probably once every 6 months. Anyway, while the ladies were talking, I climbed up on the back of Mrs. Whittle's couch and I stole the little cuckoo out of her cuckoo clock and took it home, supposedly to look after it. I used to talk to this at night when I went to bed and pretend that I was feeding it and everything. But unfortunately, Mum found it when she was making my bed and knew that Mrs. Whittle was frustrated and couldn't understand why the clock still said cuckoo, but no cuckoo came out the little hole to say cuckoo. And, of course, as soon as Mum saw it, she realised. So she made me carry it in my open hand across these paddocks, probably about 3 kilometres, to present this cuckoo back to Mrs. Whittle. So that was my first introduction to caring for birds. We ticked along. Peter did a little bit of work, but not very much. By the time David reached the age of 5, he was very much an out farm boy. Did not want to sit at the table to do stupid things like schoolwork. So Mum developed a scheme that I would sit on the opposite side of the table and work with him. The teachers at the Correspondence School in Wellington were very understanding about this, and they used to send little things in the way of work for me to do. So by the time I was 5, I was reading and writing quite fluently. The only problem with my writing was that, like my father, I was very left-handed, and also like him, who had been forced to write right-handed, I was persuaded to write right-handed. I think that in today's terms, I would probably be termed dyslexic, because now, if I'm writing on a page, I will write with my right hand. But if I'm writing on the blackboard, when I was doing tutoring, nursing, I would write with my left hand. And now I can write pretty well as well with my left hand as I can with my right. And I think that with other things, I'm so left-handed that I think I was probably persuaded to write right-handed. This did cause problems when we were doing any farming projects or anything, particularly screwing screws. I could never remember whether I went right or left to unscrew or screw up. And Peter, being the bright lad that he was, used to ridicule me for this, and there was a large amount of bullying that went on, to the extent that I learnt quite soon how to avoid conflict by either shutting up completely or disappearing off the scene so that there was no one to have conflict with. I think this has been quite an asset throughout my life, having learnt to do this. There was the usual run of dogs, cats, lambs, calves, pigs, chooks, pet rabbits, and if we had these things, they were always our responsibility to look after and care for. Mum and Dad were humane and kind to us about this sort of thing, but they just didn't have the time to be fiddling around with us and pets. Peter was given 2 beautiful dogs. One was a whippet, which we used to take out for rabbiting, and the other was a little Australian terrier, which Mum adopted as hers. Peter had no interest in animals. He loved cats, but every cat that he had always had a bad temper, which matched his. He had no inclination whatever with lambs or any of the other animals that we had. He never learnt to milk. Perhaps that was wise. David and I learnt to milk at quite a young age, and we would often get saddled with milking our cows. These were more than just cows for the house. We used to separate the cream, and that was sold to the Hiratonga Dairy Factory in Hastings, being collected once a week from a gateway half a mile down the road from us. Dad, or later Peter, would take the cans of cream down to the gateway to be picked up by the truck. So David and I would be milking cows. I always looked after the pet lambs. The pigs were always my responsibility. The chooks were free range, but it was always my responsibility to find the nests and find the eggs before they'd been sat on until they were past using. Peter and I had pet rabbits. David only saw a rabbit as a means of getting food. A lot of our time was spent harvesting, shooting rabbits, bows and arrows, shanghais later. As a 9-year-old, I was regarded as being responsible enough to be out shooting rabbits with a .22 rifle. No supervision. I can imagine what health and safety would say about that nowadays. David very, very quickly took to hunting deer. He would disappear with the .303 rifle, an old Ensign post-war firearm. He'd disappear with that, tell me where he was going, and just disappear from Mum and Dad and go out hunting and come back with more venison meat on his shoulders, more than his own body weight he'd be bringing home. Our diet mainly consisted of rabbits, venison, and eels. We were always in the creek catching eels in the summertime because they hibernated in the winter. And so we became the providers along the way as well. We never had a car. Dad used to borrow the neighbour's car, probably annually, to take us to town to go to the dental nurse, which I hated. I was always car sick. Couldn't even get 3 kilometres down the road to the post office and I'd be car sick. Peter used to always say, put her head in a paper bag. These drives to town were always a huge adventure, for the boys in particular, but I hated it because of the car sickness. Mum would be in the front with Dad, and we 3 kids would be squished into the back, and I'd be between the 2 boys, and there'd always be fights. I hated it. The road was rough metal. Half the time the vegetation would be crashing onto each side of the car. It was so narrow. And I remember one particular trip we came round what is now the Pātaka Cutting, a very sharp hairpin bend, and there was an old sow, a wild sow, laying on her side, feeding her umpteen babies, probably 10 or 12 of them, all hooked onto her having their lunch or whatever it was. And you never go near a sow with its piglets. They're extremely dangerous and protective. And I remember sitting there in this hot car, and Dad had his hand out the window and he was tapping the side of the car in frustration, waiting for this old pig to finish feeding her babies. And finally she gave a switch of her tail and noosh, got up and walked off into the fern and the babies trailing along behind her. But the trips used to take probably anything up to 4 hours or longer to even get to town. We'd rush around, go to the dental clinic, do any emergency shopping, jump back in the car and come back home. We used to be given probably a penny to spend. David never spent any money. He'd go walk along the streets with his head down looking for money in the gutters that he could pick up. I used to always buy an ice cream. I don't quite know what Peter did with his, but David was the saver in the family. We used to get our groceries once every 6 months. They'd be delivered to the farm from Hughes' shop, which housed everything from a needle to a saddle to a keg of whiskey. Everything that you wanted to buy, you could get from this shop, which was situated at Risington. Unfortunately, this whole building, which was originally just a big house with shelves set up in each room to hold different things, was inundated with silt in the recent Cyclone Gabriel a couple of years ago. This building has now been, sadly, completely demolished, and every time you go past, you think of what that building held. Every time the groceries were ordered, they'd come and Dad would give the truck driver the money for the bill, and then the next lot of groceries would come, and there'd always be a little bag of lollies as a thank you for having paid your bill on time. Mum kept control of those lollies, otherwise I would have eaten the lot at the time, but David hardly ever ate any. He saved them. The boys and Mum and I had one holiday in 1946, and Nellie Whittle, the neighbour, came with us to their beach cottage at Halmoana. This was an eye-opener to us, one, to see the sea, and two, to play in the sand. Swimming was right out of the question because the sea was regarded as a bit too dangerous, and Mum was never a swimmer, so we didn't go in the water much. So going to the beach with Nellie Whittle was fun and also quite strenuous. A little sideline, Nellie was courting at that stage, and Mum was sort of the stand-in mother for her. Nellie was a wonderful entertainer. She was a real light in any party. Although I was only six, she jacked it up with me that I would jump into her bed and she would be out with her boyfriend. Anyway, this particular night that she jacked this up, she sneaked into bed with me and left her bed empty. Mum did a check on her, and of course, whatever the time was, 10 o'clock at night or something, and Nellie wasn't in her bed. And the next morning, Mum was going to wrap her up properly about staying out. Meanwhile, of course, Nellie had been tucked up in bed with me, and so that one backfired on poor old Mum. Very, very well-known family from Pukatitu, right back to their great-grandparents, and there's still descendants of them up there. During most of my earlier childhood, say up to about 12 years old, with the bullying I received from Peter, which always caused problems, I would disappear probably for a whole day at a time, even from about the time I was five. I'd grab a few peas or a few carrots out of the garden. There was always a huge, beautiful vegetable garden which Dad maintained and planted. So I'd grab these peas and carrots and I'd go off into the Balls Clearing Scenic Reserve. Often go in the morning and Mum would come looking for me. Often Mum would be crying in her desperation to find me and I would hide. And poor Mum would go round the trees calling me, "Pammy, Pammy, Pammy." And I'd just hide there and never own up that I was there. And poor Mum would go back home and imagine the agony she must have gone through. But again, we got there. The boys used to do things together. And I was always the add-on, I suppose. We had a lot of boys around us and no girls at all. The Maxwell boys used to come up. The Ramage boys, when they were there on holiday, used to come over. Whittles always had lovely high school-aged boys from town coming up to the farm for holidays. And we used to have these hilarious get-togethers, particularly eeling. And we'd go over to the creek in Bushy Park and all meet up there. Mum and Mrs. Ramage and Nellie Whittle used to bring over tins of baking, and we'd have these wild eeling parties round the creek. Nellie Whittle used to always bring rotten eggs, which I think she'd stored up probably for a year, and there'd be these egg fights. Presumably you'd put the eggs in the water and that would attract the eels, but invariably the eggs went elsewhere. Somebody would push or fall into the creek. So we'd be coming home cold and wet and smelling of rotten eggs. But that was part of growing up, I suppose. It used to be wonderful there. I remember the outline of the trees against the moonlight sky and the moorhawks calling in the trees. And out on the farmland, the cattle would be laying there probably over full and sighing and chewing their cuds. And sometime at night when it was well and truly dark, the adults would gather up the kids, or what was left of the kids, and drag us off home again. But those eeling parties were really, I suppose, our socialisation for the year. Harvesting was always a good time too, because all the local farmers used to come in and help everybody with their harvesting. Dad used to go off for days and weeks at a time, coming home at night, helping the neighbours over the fence with whatever they were doing, whether it was harvesting or shearing or whatever. Dad also inherited the ability from my great-grandfather to be a farrier. And all the district horses used to come to us for shoeing. And in those days, of course, all transport was by horseback and all farm work was done by horses. It was my job, from a little tiny thing, to man the forge in the shed where Dad used to do the shoeing. This was a homemade thing that my great-grandfather had made using skins as bellows, and a manuka pole as a handle. And the fire used to be in the metal bowl at the end. And my job was to work the lever, the pole, and puff the air into the firebox to keep the embers burning to heat the horseshoes with before they were fitted to the horse's feet. It was a real art to get the handle operating for a start, because I was so short and so little that I had to jump on the handle to bring it down. And then, of course, to push it up, to get more air into the bellows, I had to stand on tiptoes and reach right above my head to let the handle go up high enough and keep on puff, puff, puffing to keep the fire going. It was a real art to keep embers in the fire bowl and not have wild flames lashing everywhere. This went on for years, and all the neighbours used to bring their horses to Dad for shoeing. I loved it, partly because it meant that I could handle the horses as well. We had three Clydesdale draft horses for our farm work, and one of them was a little bit of a mongrel ill-bred, I suppose. She was very, very small, but she had a wonderful temperament, and I learnt to ride on the Whittle's donkey first, but I learnt to ride this horse, even though she was not a riding horse. She was a workhorse, and I used to be able to saddle her up and lead her everywhere and do everything with her. Again, Peter never touched the horses, never touched the animals. Mum got really upset one day when she lost David and found he was out in the sheepyards. By then, the oldest mare had just produced a foal, and here's David putting this mare and the foal down the sheepyards and drafting them off. Such was his instinct of sheep work, drafting them off and separating the mare from her baby. And she never harmed him. But when Mum saw what he was doing, she was too scared to yell out to him in case she frightened the old mare or David panicked or something went wrong. So she just had to stand at the fence and watch him putting his horses back through the yards again and then separating them and putting them back through the yards again. And the size of the horse compared to the size of sheep going down the race, of course, broke down the boarding at the side of the race. So David and I had to do quick surreptitious repairs of the race before Dad found out what had happened. I think Dad probably knew anyway, but he never growled at us over that. Apart from the chores that I mentioned, the milking, which was the big thing, quite, we were milking 15 cows at one stage, hand milking them. David would invariably go off hunting and Dad would be out fencing or doing some work on the farm. And Peter would be absent. Don't ask where, because no one knew. And I'd end up, particularly at night, milking these 15 cows by hand on my own. I quite loved the old cows, or one or two that our personalities clashed, but mostly they were just hybrid cows. And I remember very clearly leaning my head against the flank of a cow tired at night at the end of a day, and I'd be listening to the Kiwis out in the bush, just running around doing what Kiwis do. I don't think many people have the opportunity of doing that these days. Dad had a particular aversion to blood, although he was a very competent butcher. That was another sideline that my great-grandfather had taught him. With Dad being illegitimate and being brought home to the farm as a seven-year-old, great-grandfather was the father influence in his life, and he taught Dad many, many skills, which was the father's responsibility to teach their son in those days. But great-granddad had taught my father the butchery trade, because when he had his own bullock team, part of his income was selling meat. He would go out onto the Kaweka Flats for a week at a time, just with his horse, and a little bag of rolled oats, and a little bag of salt, and he'd stay out there for a week, shooting the wild bulls with his own muzzle loader firearm. He said in one of his letters to his mother what a dirty, dangerous job it was. The Lutty, of course, would be left with the three children, running the farm as she could and milking the house cows, doing what she could do to keep the farm going while he was away. He never had a timepiece with him, but she used to mark the days off on the calendar. And exactly a week later, he would come home with his horse laden with wild bull meat, and he'd then butcher it up. He built his own butcher's shed and take it around the district selling it for about a shilling a pound, which for the amount of work involved in getting it was just blood money. This shed that he built for his butcher's shed, I'm diverting here, had an 18-foot stud and an endless chain from the roof down onto the concrete floor, which he had mixed and made himself. I mean, making concrete in those days, how he got the skills to do it, I don't know. The whole floor was gently sloping so that the blood would run down into one corner and out onto a collection tray. And when it had coagulated, he used to scoop that up and put it in a drum and use it either for compost for the garden or for an additive for the chooks' food. We used to use the leftover skim milk and provide curd for the chooks as an addition to their normal diet. Dad carried on a lot of things that great-grandfather had taught him to do, and this followed on then to my brother David, who inherited the farm. David remained in the old crofter style of calling your sheep instead of droving them. He would sit up on top of the hill with his one little dog beside him. You could call the sheep, and they would come to you to go through the gate into the next paddock or wherever you wanted to take them. A lot of people laughed at David over this. He was a very private person and lived a very private life. Unfortunately, neither of my brothers got married, so I never had any sisters-in-law. Another gimmick that we used to get up to as kids was to make our own skating rink. On the frosty nights, if you picked the time of night when it was after dark and carry buckets of water down to a little sloping hill that went down into the creek, and if you let the bucket overflow and flow down this slope, it used to freeze as it flowed down. And we used to call this our skating rink, and you could stand at the top in your boots and slither and slide and skate down to the water's edge. Sometimes we misjudged and went right into the water, which didn't really thrill Mum very much. With this creek that ran right beside the house, it was quite a short creek, but it was both an education and a horror to us. Peter deliberately tried to drown me in it twice, actually. When I was 6 months old, Mum used to put me out in the pram out in the garden of an afternoon for a sleep. And apparently at that stage I never cried, made up for it later. But she used to watch through the kitchen window, and when she could see the pram jiggling, she'd know I was awake and go out and bring me in. But this particular time the pram wasn't jiggling, and she thought, well, Pam's sleeping there a long time, I wonder what it is. And she went down to the pram, and the blankets were folded back and the pram was empty. She panicked, of course, and then heard a squeak or a commotion or something. And Peter had me down by the creek. This is in winter. There was snow on the ground. So I'd have been 6 months old. Had me by the feet, and I was completely undressed. And he was attempting to get me in the water without getting himself wet. That was the first time. The second time was when he had me in a little cart at the top of the hill. And he dug a series of roads down the side of this hill and set off from the top of the hill with the cart and then let it go. And, of course, Cart and Pam went careering down the hill and into the dam at the bottom, turned upside down over me. And I remember this quite clearly. I was on my knees with the cart over my back, and my head was just above the water, which was coming up inside the cart. The cart was too heavy for me to get it off me. Anyway, dear old brother David came to the bank of the creek and was able to reach out and give the cart a kick, which got it off my back, and I could stand up and go into Mum's sobs and stories of mud and creek and everything else. Peter ran away for the day, and of course, by the time he got home at night, they were busy finishing off the milking and getting tea and everything else, and not too much was said about it. But I remember that lot quite clearly.
What age would you have been?
I'd have been about 7 then. We used to build huts too, usually using manuka. I think probably from the influence of my great-grandfather through Dad, somehow or other I'd learnt to thatch, the same as I learnt to plait. And we used to thatch the roofs of these huts with manuka. They were quite useful little places. David and I sometimes used to go out and sleep in them. We'd officially go to bed and then we'd sneak out at night and go and sleep in the huts. Come back in the morning as though Mum and Dad thought we'd just got up. I mean, when you get to about 8, 9-year-old, parents don't go checking on you. Well, our parents didn't anyway. They send you off to bed and they assume you go to bed. They know there's no media to distract you, so they think you're going to bed to sleep. Anyway, we also played with bows and arrows. They were lethal. Peter taught us how to pound number 8 fencing wire into an arrow point and then cut little barbs on the side of it and bind them into the ends of toy toy stems. We used to make our own bows. Lancewood, a very supple wood. We used to get lancewoods and bow them into a bow with twine. They were quite successful for shooting rabbits. And then we somehow progressed onto shanghais, lethal weapons. I think this again was Peter's leadership. Peter was a tremendous reader, as Dad was. We used to, or Peter did, hop up on the sheds and pinch all the lead moulding around the tops of the sheds, and we'd melt up this lead, and we used great-granddad's bullet maker, which he used for his muzzle loader firearm, and make these balls of lead and use them in the shanghais. Well, again, Peter succeeded in giving me concussion from hitting me on the head with that and knocking me out completely with a shanghai bullet. We used to go out and have these Indian wars at night in the dark, or in the moonlight was better. We used to get the white stones off the metal road and cherish them as missiles to go in the shanghais. When I had the concussion, of course, I was pretty dopey for a week or so, headache and totally miserable. And I sat at the table one morning to start my schoolwork, and Mum growled at me about having my hair dishevelled, uncombed and unbrushed and everything. And she grabbed the comb to comb my hair. And, of course, the comb wouldn't go through my hair because of the blood in it from my head injury. Peter was quick off the mark and said, oh, yeah, the other night when she was out getting the cows in, she fell down the bank. She didn't want to tell you. So that one passed, and I got over my concussion and carried on. We always seemed to have boys at home. Mum's baking was a huge attraction, and Mum was a lovely motherly soul. Everybody loved Mum, and everybody came to Mum with their problems. And we always seemed to have boys around, but there was never any girls. There were just no other girls around the district, or if they were, they were chaperoned and not allowed to run around the world like these boys were. We used to do all sorts of things, climb trees and just generally have kids' fun, I suppose. One boy in particular was very, very kind and looked after me, Willie Maxwell. He had enormous big hands. When he started playing rugby, he could easily hold a rugby ball in one hand and you wouldn't know that he even had the ball in his hand. He had huge hands, and I remember him in particular one time. We raced off down past the creek, and the boys all ran over a single log across the creek, which was quite deep. None of us could swim, of course, and I hesitated. I suppose I was about 9. And Willie came back, and he extended this huge great hand across to me. He used to call me Pammy. He'd say, "You all right, Pammy?" And I took this huge great hand, and he just whipped me across the creek as though I didn't need to walk on the log. Things like that sort of stay with you, I suppose, because there was possibly little in our life to distract us. I grew up wearing my brother's cast-down outgrown clothing and also their boots. I can remember Dad bought me a pair of boots when I was probably about 11, and I was so proud because I had black shiny boots, but otherwise I just wore what the boys grew out of. No complaints. I mean, it was life in those days, and lots of other kids were doing the same, no doubt. I think further back, I started to say about Dad's aversion to blood. Although he was a good butcher, he could humanely disperse animals. He was always very careful with his shooting too, to humanely shoot an animal and never leave an animal injured, or even animals that were ill, he would humanely shoot them rather than let them suffer. But if any of us kids got hurt and bled, he would just go unconscious as quick as a flash. He just couldn't stand the thought of any of us being hurt or, the sight of human blood. One time, Dad and I were out mustering, which involved quite a long walk out the back. No grass paddocks then, just scrub and fern, wild pigs. And I slipped on a rock and quite badly cut my knee. And the blood was everywhere. And I remember taking Dad's hat down to the creek to fill it with water to bring back, to put over him to wake him up or give him to drink. I can't remember. But anyway, all this blood pouring down my leg, and here's me staggering off down to the creek to get him water to revive him. And then I just wrapped the wound up with a flax leaf and we carried on mustering. Just the way you did things in those days. But having visitors, it was always quite a rare occasion. We very seldom had any visitors. The neighbours once in a while used to come. It was Edwin McBurney. He used to come from another neighbour. When they moved in, they were probably our nearest neighbours. They were nearly a mile away. It always meant, of course, the fire was always going. Dad lit the fire of a morning when he got up and put the last chock of wood on the fire when he went to bed at night. He was always first up and last to bed. There was always boiling water on the stove, and it didn't matter what hour of the day or night a visitor did turn up. There was always a cup of tea, a cup of soup, or a hot meal. Both Granny and Mum were expert scone makers, and there was always food at any hour of the day or the night, which meant, of course, that David and I, sitting at the kitchen table to do our school lessons, had to pack everything up and push them to the side while the visitors were there. We loved it. We loved visitors coming. Well, I did anyway. David, being shy, would take off and go outside and do something until the visitors had gone. But for me, it just meant a break in schooling and, a different face to look at. Now we can get on to the dreaded subject of education, I suppose. It wasn't dreaded for me because I loved it. I loved learning. I read tremendously. Had an unlimited supply of library books from the correspondence school. All our work, of course, was read and then written answers. No computers, no communication at all. And having started school as a four-year-old, I suppose I had a bit of a head start on the others. Anyway, I caught up with David and we did our work together. We were both sort of at the same level, although he was almost that year ahead of me. Years in those days didn't count for schooling. It was what you achieved at school let you be promoted on to the next class. And so David and I worked at the same level right through from Standard 1 until we went off to Napier to set school certificate together. Mum got David in as a temporary boarder at the Napier Boys High School, and she got me into the Randall House Orphanage up on Napier Terrace, and I walked across to the Napier Girls High School to set my school certificate subjects. That's another whole story. It was a hideous ordeal for me. But during our schooling with correspondence, David was very, very good at drawing and map making, a very artistic little guy, whereas I was good with the blurbing and the writing. And so we used to swap our subjects. I'd write out his stories on rough paper, and then he'd just write them in his own writing. And he used to do my paintings. And the teachers never knew. David was always getting extremely high marks for his writing. And coming from a boy, that was pretty terrific. And I got highly commended for my artwork. Mum coped with correspondence schooling in the house for 17 years. No wonder she went grey early. No wonder she had bad health. Trying to keep Peter to task was just about impossible. David was not interested in schooling one little bit. All he could think of was getting out and farming. He taught himself to shear. Dad couldn't teach him because Dad was left-handed with his shearing and everything was wrong way round. So David basically watched Dad shearing and converted everything else into his own hand and learnt to shear. He became a very good shearer and was well sought after in the district to go out onto the different farms to help with shearing tasks. Going back to our schooling, three visiting teachers came to our house in that 17 years of correspondence schooling. Mum used to take us over to the McBurney's to listen to the correspondence school annual breakup. I don't think Peter ever went. David went under protest, and I loved going because I used to hear my name read out at prize giving.
Was that over the radio?
Yes, over the radio. We actually didn't have a radio until probably I was about 11, I think, and Peter got an old radio from somewhere, but it was battery operated, and the battery always seemed to be having to come to town to get charged up again. And Peter controlled what we listened to, so we never really grew up with radio. The phone came into use in 1954. We were then on a party line of 8 people and we were rung up by a code. Ours was one long ring and 2 short rings. And when the phone rang to that, we could pick it up and answer. The phone only operated 9 to 5, Monday to Friday anyway. And there was a neighbour down the road on our party line who they suspected was eavesdropping on phone calls. She was a very sweet lady, but a little bit intellectually deprived. And Mum and Mrs. Whittle were having a chat on the phone line one day, and Mrs. Whittle said to my mother, "Oh, well, Mrs. Lewis," they never called themselves by their maiden names, "just between you and I and down the road, such and such." And there was a clap, and this voice came on, "I am not listening to the phone." And down would go the receiver. It's fairly obvious she was listening to the phone. Just another way of keeping occupied in the country. And the power came to us. We got the power in 1972. By which time, of course, I'd long left the farm anyway. We'll digress a little bit and go back to 1949. Dad had always promised Mum a new house. And, of course, Dad had his own problems with health also. And Minnie, our beloved granny, died. And that created huge problems because Dad had to pay death duties, which was a colossal amount of money in those days. Thousands of pounds, not dollars, pounds, which just about took us off the farm trying to cope with the expense. There was never a lot of money anyway, but having to pay death duties when Minnie passed away was just the final straw, and things very nearly did collapse. Dad became very depressed and spent most of his time out hunting. Mum was trying to cope. Peter was not cooperative. It was a very, very hard time. In 1949, on my birthday, Dad had cut up one of the logs that was left lying in the paddock and the remnants of the bush, balls clearing, and shaped them into piles. In 1949, on my birthday, he put in the first pile to be the beginning of the new house. And things progressed gradually, slowly, a bit at a time. He was taking outside work, trying to shear for neighbours, build up a few pounds here and there. Peter was given the opportunity to attend a correspondence summer school at Massey College in those days, and somehow they got enough or obtained proper school uniform, because the boys even had to wear caps in those days, knee-length socks, proper uniform. So Peter went off to Massey College for correspondence summer school camp. Was a naughty boy, got sick, ended up in the hospital, came back sadly with bad things of community living. He taught us a few naughty games, such as how to give Chinese burns, which he used to do on my wrists. He did teach us how to play rounders, but of course there was only 3 of us for the team anyway, and the boys could always hit harder and faster and further than I could, so I was always at the bottom of the team. Yes, that was quite devastating when Peter came back. He didn't gain from that. A few years later, of course, it came David's turn to go to correspondence school camp. David didn't really want to go, but Mum and Dad thought it would be beneficial for him. And he could inherit Peter's uniform anyway. So they dragged that out of mothballs. And David went off to Massey College and immediately was made deputy head prefect. He was put in charge of taking a group of boys to the Palmerston North Show. David had never been to a show in his life before and was completely out of his depth. These 3 other boys that he was in charge of were only his own age, were sophisticated little lads who knew their way around society. And immediately ran away and left poor David parading the showgrounds looking for them, terribly devastated that he failed in his duty of looking after these little wretches as boys. Anyway, all was done. No teachers growled at him or anything. He got the boys back in time to get on the bus, get back to Massey. They'd done it on purpose, of course, because they were well schooled up. They knew where they wanted to go at a show and what they wanted to see. Poor David didn't have a clue. And then, of course, it came the girls' turn to be at Massey College. David also ended up quite ill in the Palmerston North Hospital, no fault of his own. And when he was going to Massey, I said to Mum, "Well, I hope David doesn't get sick or it'll spoil my chances of going." And David never talked very much about it, but it was a very eye-opening experience for him. Because he was such a good all-rounder, he got glowing reports of leadership and all these nice things said about him. But he never told us very much about Massey at all. And then, of course, he ended up sick in the hospital anyway. And that just put paid. I never got my chance to go to Massey College, which I was quite desperate about. I think I wanted to be quite social, but didn't quite know how to be. And, of course, there was no others to socialise with anyway. When David went to the boys' high school, to set his correspondence schooling. It was a huge ordeal for him. As I've said before, he was not an academic, but he strived. He really tried hard. He scratched through, which was a real credit to him and a credit to Mum for helping him through his schooling the way she did. My experience of going to the Napier Girls High School to set school certificate was sheer hell. For a start, Mum had put me into one of her dresses. I don't think I'd even been out of boys' clothing all my life. And I had this awful old pair of sandals on my feet. And I had to walk from Napier Terrace over to the girls' high school. Got there in plenty of time. I knew about punctuality. And I saw this beautifully manicured little girl in school uniform on the street just behind the girls' high school. Beautiful little dapper blonde. And I went up to her. In my stumbling, fumbling way, I told her who I was and why I was at the girls' high school. She tossed her blonde hair and said, "What's that?" to me, walked through the back gate, because she was obviously the milk monitor, shut the gate behind her, and walked off up the steps to the school. And I felt devastated that another person could talk to me like that. What's it to me? Anyway, I went round the front of the school, and there were what seemed like thousands of kids. Found the classroom somehow that I was to be in to sit English. Walked into this classroom. There was the beautifully presented adjudicator sitting at a desk at the front of the hall. And these kids came in, all sitting at their individual desks. Some of them started to cry when they opened the papers and saw the questions and didn't know them. Some of them got their heads down and started writing. Some were eating lollies. And to be in a room of other people like that, I was lost. I remember sitting there looking at the sparrow that came onto the windowsill, because we didn't have sparrows in Puketitu at that stage. And I sat there just looking at this sparrow, and then I thought, crikey, I'm meant to be sitting an exam. One thing I had learnt correspondence schooling was how to read a question and how to write an answer. So I read the questions and I wrote the answers. And then when I came out, all the other classes had finished their three-hour exam anyway, and they were all in this quadrangle. Some were laughing, some were crying, they were clutching each other. They were doing what ordinary, normal young people do, commiserating, congratulating, swapping stories, swapping lollies, swapping notes. I stood on the top of the steps and no one knew I even existed. I didn't mean a thing to anyone. I was in one of Mum's dresses. It was terrible. That left a lifelong impression on me. And from then on, I've never really got along very well with girls. I mean, I've had plenty of girlfriends and things and visitors, but never really attached to a girl as a girlfriend. So that concluded schooling. The new house was built in dribs and drabs along the way. Mum and I moved up to what we called a new house, which was just up the hill and across the creek, about 1953. I did my schoolwork up there. David didn't. David stayed at the old house doing his schoolwork. We had slightly different subjects then, because he chose an agricultural course to do for high school and I chose dressmaking, which I had hated doing as sewing in the primary school, because the boys didn't have any equivalent. Sewing in the primary school was one of the compulsory subjects and I hated doing that. But I took up clothing for high school, and one of the requirements was to make 9 garments, which carried 50% of the final exam for clothing. And the old treadle machine, of course, which had to be hand-threaded and had to turn the wheel backwards to do a reverse stitch. All it could do was one straight line of stitching, nothing fancy. My daughter has still got that sewing machine, actually, in her house. David did some beautiful work with his woodwork. Again, he had inherited Dad's ability to do this sort of thing. So anyway, between Dad and David and I and Peter on the sidelines, we built the house, which is now still a haven on the farm. And Peter moved up when he was home, which was not very often. And then Dad and David moved up when the old house was finally sliding down into the creek. The house we've got now, I had it changed a little bit and finally finished in 2000, actually. David died in 1999 when he was just 60. So I had the back of the house changed a little bit. I had a shower put in and a room made for a washing machine and that sort of thing put in, and got the house updated. I finished all the stuff in the house that had not been done. A lot of the rooms had never been painted, floors covered, put in a wood burner stove, put in a new kitchen sink, and got rid of the boiler from the old wood burning stove, because by then we had the electricity, hot water. Did the house up properly, so now it's an absolute haven to my 6 grandkids who can't get up there quick enough to be there.
It's still in the family.
Oh, yes. My grandkids are sixth generation. We've kept the farm in the family. David, of course, did a wonderful job farming it from my great-grandfather's 9 sheep. By the time he died, it was farming 3,000. I had all the paddocks broken in. I have since had riparian strips put along some of the creeks. And towards the latter part, when David's health was failing, I was up at the farm much more. And we fenced off regenerating patches of bush. Yes, I took over running the farm for quite lengthy intervals when he was either in hospital or ill. And then I went back to the farm for the last stage of his life. I nursed him up there until he became paraplegic. He had cancer and it affected his spine. When I couldn't cope any longer running the farm and nursing him as a paraplegic, I brought him to town and nursed him until he died in 1999. I finished schooling in 1997. I'd had quite a few hitches with rheumatic fever and bad health and stuff, so my school certificate was delayed for a year because of missed schooling. Yes, I had few health hiccups and lost quite a bit of time in schooling. Sat school certificate in 1957 and just carried on with general farm work, mainly helping Dad and David. David, by which time, had been called up for his military training in the army, was very, very successful. While David was at Linton Military Camp, he was in charge of the Bren gun, doing field infantry training up in the Tararuas a lot. He refused promotions, which he was offered many times in the army. He enjoyed going to the army for his rehearsal training every year and regarded that as a holiday. He was stationed mostly at Waiuru. And what finally put him off from going was when he was pleaded with to form a security guard of honour for royalty visiting. David didn't like publicity, so he quit the army, which sort of cut out really what was his annual holiday. Anyway, I stayed on the farm. I was too young. I had decided by then that I wanted to go maternity nursing. Had there been more choices for a young girl at that stage, I think if I'd had the brains, I probably would have followed up and become a vet. But anyway, there were so few choices for women in those days. It was either marry the guy over the back fence, become a secretary or receptionist, go nursing or go teaching. And I decided, well, I didn't know too much about nursing, although Mum did try to impart into me, you know, basic nursing cares. But anyway, I decided I'd go maternity nursing.
And what year, Pam?
So that was 1958, the October 1958, the 6th of October. I said goodbye to the farm and came to Hastings Hospital to become a maternity nurse. Again, I knew how to read questions and how to put my head down and answer questions, so I flew through the training. I did find the practical side very hard, trying to mix with girls. I wasn't into their social way of life. All of them had to wash their hair at exactly the same time every week or whatever to look fine for boyfriends. Boys, to me, were just a cussed nuisance around the place. Anyway, of course, having grown up on the farm with tramping and running around in the bush all the time, I was able to continue this by joining the Hiratonga Tramping Club. I already knew the president and a few of the important names in the tramping club because they'd been out at the farm and had always come into us to talk about Balls Clearing Scenic Reserve. This reserve had by then well become a part of our family. Great-grandfather's one sadness about falling the bush to make a farm was that all these magnificent trees were getting felled. And he really was the pioneer to starting Balls Clearing Scenic Reserve as a reserve. You know, he fenced as much as he could and kept his stock out of the remaining remnants of the bush that were left, which is now the current reserve. And the preservation of this reserve was handed down through our family, which now I am handing down to my grandchildren. Anyway, I joined the Hiratonga Tramping Club and they took me wonderful places and they really were a home from home for me. They took me into their homes and got me out of the hideous confinement of the nursing homes. The nursing hostels were so old-fashioned, I suppose. Well, they weren't old-fashioned at the time. It was just current thing. But we had to be in our room by 9:30 at night, lights out at 10. They came and did room rounds on us. Had to sign a book if we were going out of the building as to where we were going and when we were coming back. Just generally looking after young maidens, I suppose, because on the other side of the fence there'd be all the sailors from the Napier port coming over looking for a night out. So I suppose the old matron did have her responsibilities. I mean, an 18-year-old girl then was not as free as 18-year-olds are nowadays. Anyway, I got through my exams pretty easily. I knew how to work. I knew how to be punctual. I tried to be kind to everybody, and that all stood in good stead. And I suddenly thought, well, maternity nursing's only halfway. I'll do general nursing training. So I got accepted, popped off down to Palmerston North Hospital, got a 6-month taken off my general nursing training because I was already a qualified maternity nurse, joined up with the Palmerston North Tramping Club, which kept me sane, got a motorbike, tootled around here, there and everywhere, did my own thing, passed all the exams. I was second in New Zealand in the final exams, qualified as a registered nurse, carried on there as a staff nurse. By then I was able to do a few naughty things with student nurses, as students always do. Instead of going for tea at night when we're on night shift, some of us used to pop down to the hydrotherapy pool in the physiotherapy department and have a swim. We got pimped on and nearly caught one night, but because I was big and tall, I could hop over the half-wall frame and get out and into my uniform, wet, and get back to my ward without getting caught. The sad thing was I left my petticoat hanging up on the hook in the cubicle. The matron, who had to be as strict as all matrons had to be, advertised that she had this petticoat belonging to somebody and if they wanted to claim it, to go and get it. And I knew that if I went to claim my petticoat, she'd know who the culprit was. So I lost a petticoat out of that lot. But we had innocent fun, just good fun, I suppose. But again, I related more to the tramping club than I did to my fellow nurses. The matron and I were not seeing eye to eye. I was on the committee for the nurses' ball. And it was no fault of my own, but the car I'd gone with, I'd filled in for one of my nursing mates, had a bloke that wanted a blind date to go to the ball, so I filled in. And after the ball was when the fun started. They went into their in-house party, to do what you do at a party, and I sat in the car and waited for them, which of course meant that I missed room rounds getting back. Got reported for being out after hours at nurse's ball, which I was aggrieved about because I'd been sitting in the car waiting for these wretched partygoers to come back and take me home. And a few other things. Oh, the matron didn't approve of me hanging out my tent to dry where it could be seen by the public. She didn't approve of me going out and spending nights out in the bush. We generally were on different wavelengths, I suppose. She meant well.
Do you recall her name?
Yes, I do recall her name. This was at Palmerston North Hospital. She was old school. And the interesting part was that I had nursed a soldier who had been in the trenches with her at the time of the war. And she was a little maiden in those days. She wasn't a matron. Anyway, those stories remain hidden. But what she was trying to prevent her nurses from doing was exactly what she had done. I saw fit to further my nursing education, so I applied to do midwifery in Auckland. And I got accepted. I was under 24 then. And when I took in my resignation to the matron, she more or less, in her terms, called me a fool and an idiot. So I was far too young. I would never be accepted in a place like that to do midwifery. So I stood there with my hands behind my back and I said, well, matron, I've already been accepted. So that just drew another line between us. What I didn't know until afterwards was that she had me in line to run what would have been the first intensive care unit hospital. So I blew that through, I suppose, lack of communication between us. She had me eyed up to take what would have been a fantastic position because I love the intensive care nursing.
Do you regret that now?
Oh, it's over now. I enjoyed my midwifery. Again, I joined the Auckland Tramping Club and had quite a lucky escape there with them. They had a bus and they were going to do quite an extensive trip in the Coromandel Peninsula. And I was to go on this trip, but I was late getting off duty and they left without me. And the bus crashed on the Coromandel Peninsula. No one was killed, but a few were hurt. I wasn't on the bus. But during my training, I had some amazing experiences. Palmerston, again, I was reliable. I was punctual. I kept my head about me doing emergency things. And I was given pretty well all the flights then with the medical aircraft doing flights to the different hospitals. We flew up to Rotorua. We flew to Gisborne. Went by ambulance to New Plymouth, to Wellington. In those days, they didn't have their trained personnel like they have now. I used to get grabbed if I was off duty and taken on these trips, which I just excelled in. I loved. Again, doing midwifery in Auckland, I don't know why, but I was the lucky one that, lucky perhaps, got a trip on the hydrofoil across to Great Barrier Island to a maternity case, which was stressful, but it was an experience. I get to the door of the house and there's crying women everywhere, blood all down the hallway, and mother laid out on the bed. Where's the baby then? Tears. Oh, there was an Alsatian dog involved in the commotion. And I tracked the trail of blood up the hallway, and there's poor baby still headfirst in the toilet. I shouldn't laugh, but now it seems unreal. Picked little baby out, wiped its little face on the bottom of my uniform, and it took a breath. Took it back to the hospital and we had it in the incubator and mum in bed and everything was fine. got my trip on a hydrofoil. No time I've ever been on one. And then I came back. I was sort of commissioned to come back to the Hastings Hospital, to midwifery. I deviated there because the matron at Waipu House had not had a holiday in 12 years, and I knew the secretary out there who pleaded with me to go and take charge of Waipu House while the current matron had a holiday. It was supposed to be for 2 weeks. She went over to the islands and had such a lovely time that she wanted a bit longer, so I think I was there for 2 months. I enjoyed the old folk. Change of pace. I enjoyed them. But, yeah, came back to the Hastings Hospital and carried on there as their senior midwife. I suddenly thought, it was a toss-up as to whether I do the premature infant course that was available in Auckland or do Plunket nursing. And I wanted to go to Dunedin because it was near the Alps for tramping, climbing. So I popped off down to Dunedin and did my Plunket training. Again, the old matron and I didn't see eye to eye. She didn't think that a girl should go out. I mean, I was, 26 by then. She didn't see that a girl should go out with a tent and camp under a tree somewhere. And again, she was old school. And we had to sign a book when we were leaving the nurse's home. And write in the book where we were going to be for the night. And I didn't know. I was going up Central Otago, but I didn't know where I'd be that night. And I just put under a tree. And she strongly disapproved and called me to the office. And I said, well, I don't know where I'll be. This is in the winter time. I'll be out camping somewhere. I might camp if I get tired driving, or I might camp if I see a pretty place and I want to stay. And anyway, she rang my mother from Dunedin, rang my mother and said, your daughter is going out and doesn't know where she's going, but she'll be camping under a tree. And my mother said, oh, good on her, she'll love that. That'll be wonderful for her. That was the sympathy she got. Anyway, we didn't perhaps see quite eye to eye, but I qualified with Plunket, sat the exam and passed it, no hassle. Had a taste of South Island climbing by then. Got in with the Otago Tramping and Mountaineering Club, and I was one of the few people in those days that had a car. So we used to fill my car with students from either the medical school or the university or the veterinary school or somewhere. Roof rack on top, fill with our packs and our ice axes and our crampons, and take off somewhere. Pretty well all over you could get over. One interesting trip I had there was with them up the Old Man Range behind Roxburgh. We were in a snow cave, and there was a bit of a roar and a crash and a thunder in the night, and the stars suddenly appeared. There'd been an avalanche, and half the side of the snow cave had gone. Instead of being in the snow cave, we were half in the snow cave and half on the snow. It wasn't snowing. Yeah. And then I thought, well, better do something with my climbing experience. By then, I was an associate member of the New Zealand Alpine Club anyway. So came back, continued with all my tramping and climbing and stuff. Again, two of us hadn't come back from a trip. We'd been waylaid by the remainder of the party. A whole group of us spent an extra night camped on the shores of Lake Tarawera after we'd climbed Mount Tarawera. And one young boy, who simply was a tramping companion, nothing romantic or anything attached, this boy's mother hit the roof because he wasn't home. And she rang my mother. And my dear mother said, oh, well, if Trevor's away with Pam, he'll be perfectly safe. He's not in any danger at all. If they're away together, he's perfectly safe. Don't worry about him. Which wasn't the answer that this mother wanted. Anyway, we duly got home safely. There was no risk, no problems, nothing. And then I led a party of trampers. It was in the days when the private people were allowed to cross the Milford Track without becoming one of the tourist party members. And they called us freedom campers, and we had to wear wristbands to distinguish us from the tourist people. So I led a party across the Milford Track by default, as the leader had problems and couldn't carry out his commitments. That went very well, and by then I thought, well, right, let's bite the bullet. And the next year, I took a party of 17 across the Southern Alps. We went in at Mount Cook and came out on the Welcome Flats, just south of the Franz Josef Glacier. That was a fantastic trip, the largest party that ever crossed the Alps at once. Yeah, just a fantastic all-round trip. I handpicked the party as to who was available and who was willing to go. Unfortunately, there were no other girls available to go. And one boy was not too long out of high school. He had a very unhappy childhood, very unhappy time at school. And the others in the party said to me, don't take him, Pam. Leave him home. Don't take him. Anyway, I had this one vacancy. I bit the bullet and I took him. And it has changed that person's life. It has absolutely changed his entire life, that one experience. We had our moments. He got overexcited going up the pass, and he opened his pack to pull out his camera, take this dramatic photograph. We'd left the Welcome Flats hut at 4 o'clock in the morning to get over the Alps in time before the avalanches, and his sleeping bag went down the ice slope and into a crevasse. So anyway, two of us
plastic loop down and got it out of the crevasse for him and brought it back. He was all right, but that was just in parting. We had a fantastic trip, absolutely fantastic trip. We still get together and talk about it. Then I got married, had kids, and so the story goes. That's it.
Who did you marry?
I married Brian Turner. I've been widowed now quite some time. We'd actually parted before he died anyway. I think that just about sums it up as some record for what it's worth.
Thank you very much, Pam. Indeed. Very interesting recollections.
As I say, there's more. Could be a lot more, but you draw the line somewhere.
Pam's going to talk on her association with birds over her lifetime.
Well, as I said, I started my love of birds as a two-year-old when I stole the cuckoo out of my mother's friend's cuckoo clock. I then used to steal baby ducks out of the creek and rear them. These were grey ducks, which are now a very, very rare breed, simply because I loved looking after birds. I used to go around finding all the birds' nests around in the bush and around the farm and assist the parents with feeding them, which I don't think the parents appreciated. Mum and Dad certainly didn't appreciate anyway. And then it just grew from there. I remember as a four-year-old having a violent argument with my brother Peter because this little fluttering thing up in the sky, he tried to tell me it was a fantail, and I just knew it was a long-tailed bat. This is a four-year-old. Anyway, it turns out that Balls Clearing is still very much a stronghold for the long-tailed bats, and I studied these and kept records of them right through as an early teenager. And these records have been deposited in the museum in Wellington, and they are now still being used by students doing theses on bats. Dr. Fuller was the curator of the museum down there in Wellington at the time, and I had personal dealings with him about the Pukatitri bats. I've still got these records, and I also was doing daily bird recording for years and years and years. I was probably the youngest member of the Ornithological Society and Forest and Bird Protection Society. I was writing little articles for them as a young teenager while I was still at school, or still attending correspondence school. And then this gradually grew. When I was nursing at Hastings, I got summoned to a senior doctor's office, which in those days didn't happen. I was petrified, thinking, what had I done wrong? Where had I failed? Why was he calling me up? And I stood absolutely freezing in his office doorway, hands behind my back and trying not to even breathe. And he said, oh, Pam, I've got a baby blackbird. What can I do about rearing it? Which absolutely drove me through the floor. Anyway, it just went on from there. Conservation as such was never even thought of, let alone invented. And I kept all this a secret and still continued secretly, quietly on the sidelines looking after birds. I'd find a poor mashed thing on the road or something, look after it and rear it. Even my closest friends didn't know about it then. I kept it so secret. And then it just snowballed on from there. And when I had children of my own, I used to show them how to look after little birds. It gradually started coming in from the general public as word spread around. I had talks at the school and then it rolled on to schools. One school I was invited to, I ended up talking to an entire roll of 720 kids. We took them in double class sessions all day, talking and demonstrating to them. This has been an ongoing affair. Then the Department of Conservation got into conservation, or it became the Department of Conservation after it was Forestry Service, and my workload increased, publicity increased. The first real healing I did, I suppose, of any significance was on a harrier hawk who had been grovelling around on the Taupo Road by the Mohaka Bridge for at least a week with a badly broken and by then infected wing before anybody stopped to pick it up and brought it into a vet. I'd had my cat to the vet for just routine stuff. And I suppose I've been talking along the way to this vet about things. But anyway, he phoned me up and said, well, let's have a go at it, Pam. Trotted along to the vet and we splintered its wing with an ice block stick and yoo-hoo glue. I had it at my property for 6 weeks. I'd by then built an aviary for myself, scrounging material from everywhere to build this aviary. And 6 weeks later, I took this harrier hawk away and let it out of the box on the side of a gully up the Taupo Road where I thought if it flops into the gully, I can pop down and catch it again. It just spread its wings and it flew across the gully and down the river. And then it turned around, came back and did a couple of flaps over my head and went off into the distance. So I suppose that was really my first public success story because the papers got hold of that and put a photo in and stuff. Then the regional council got hold of me and asked if I'd like to go on the oiled wildlife rehabilitation team that they had at that stage, now called Wild Base, which specialises in wild birds. Put it off down to Massey University, and we had a demonstration course on crop feeding, tube feeding these baby birds.
or sick birds at that stage. And I had thought during my nursing training, well, if you can tube feed a baby, why can't you tube feed a baby bird? So I'd been secretly doing this for years. And during this demonstration, I hung back and hung back and hung back at the back of the class. Finally, the vet in charge called me up. Come on, your turn. Come and have a go. And I did it. Apart from having to turn everything around, for me being left-handed and him being right-handed, he just stood back. He said, you've done this before, haven't you? And I just had to say a quiet little yes, because it was just unheard of that you do this sort of thing. Anyway, it's just progress from there. I was involved with the Cape Sanctuary relocation of the various species of petrels out there. That progressed on to volunteering to go up to Mangahuriri Range for the first ever translocation of mottled petrel and Cook's petrels up there. I went for 10 days as a volunteer, and 2 months later I was still there. Yeah, responsibilities grew and I lapped them up and loved it. And we had lots of people coming from overseas to learn and to train. I loved that side of it too. And it's just gone on from there that I'm one of the inaugural members of the Wrens New Zealand group, which is Wildlife Rehabilitation Network of New Zealand. For many, many, many years, I've taken in birds that have been hurt and injured, come in from the public, come in from all sorts of funny places, even from the prison. Doing rehabilitation work, I have a Department of Conservation permit since the permit scheme first became invented. I think that was about 1990 that they decided they had to have these rehabilitation people permitted to do the job properly. So that's it. I suppose you could basically say I've been looking after birds for the last, well, I'm 85, so it'd be 83 years.
Are you known as the bird lady?
I'm known as quite a few things.
Yeah, no,
it's grown from there, and I've had taxi trips to Wild Base with Kiwi. My daughter and her daughter are now involved in the Kiwi recovery program out in the Kauaka Ranges. So something has spread and grown. Yes. I'm not physically capable of doing it. I've had some remarkable successes. The most adoring, I suppose you could say, would be triplet Morpork's. They were so little and so new that their eyes were still shut. They couldn't even stand up. They were so new, no feathers or anything on them.
Would that be a rarity?
Well, it's quite a rarity. They're not endangered as such, but very few people know anything about them. Being nocturnal, I mean, a lot of people know what they sound like. People don't know that they've got 7 different calls and vocabularies. They're also ventriloquists. They can make their voice sound as though it's coming from one tree and they're actually sitting up in the other tree waiting for a mouse or a cockroach to come past. To rear them has been sort of a challenge. I mean, they do this sort of thing up at the wingspan at Rotorua, but they're specialised scientists. I'm just an amateur. Yeah, and I've had a lot of success with kingfishers too. They're quite delicate to rear, baby kingfishers. And I rear these with the intention of them being released and going back into the wild. If I feel that a bird can't recover for any reason, a penguin with one flipper, birds with no eyesight, that obviously cannot be released, well, then I have no qualms about having them humanely euthanized, because sadly there is no life for them. I don't believe in caged birds. I don't have caged birds myself. But in saying that, we had one kereru, native wood pigeon, came into me as a terribly suffering chick. The fellow had cut the tree down knowing that the nest was in the tree, and he left it on the ground for 4 days in the rain and the cold and the lice before he decided to do something about it. And this bird was in a terrible state when it came to me. And I looked at it and thought, do I or don't I? And I thought, yes, it needs a chance. So a friend who's in this bird rehab with me and I took it over and we swapped it around. If one was going away, the other would have it. And we swapped that bird around, hand feeding it for 6 months. Theoretically, my permit says you can't keep a bird longer than 3 months. So anyway, finally I said to John, we've got to make a decision. This can't go on. And he made the appointment at the vet to have it euthanized, and he gave it to me to take. And I put it in my ovary that night. I said, I'm sorry, you can't go on being hand-fed. You won't feed yourself, so it's the vet tomorrow. Next morning, it was feeding itself. And I kept it for 3 weeks and took it out to my friend who had property right next to Timata Park, and we thought this was a good place for it to go. He wanted to photograph it. We decided we'd put it on his bird table with his photographs. I took it out of the cage. I held it up to give it a little goodbye kiss. It flew out of my arms and away before he got his photograph. His wife spent about a week looking for it and was sure she could see it up in the tree because it had a little bit of feathers where it had been hand-fed. The feathers weren't quite fluffed out properly underneath its chest. And she thought, that's Pam's pigeon. We never did find its body, and it was never reported as being dead. But that was just one of the things. Well, I had another one, again a kereru. Its first flight out of its nest just south of Havelock, and it flew into an upstairs window, split all its crop open. And the very caring owners rushed it to me, was still bleeding, still hemorrhaging. So the first thing I did was stop the bleeding, and I thought, this is going to be a vet's job. I mean, I am limited in what I can do. So I rushed it up to the vet, and luckily there was a very compassionate vet just about to start her lunch break. She said, well, I'll do it, but it won't live. She spent 2.5 hours doing surgery on it. The whole crop was split on both sides, the front and at the back. Stitched it up, phoned me to say the job's done, you can have it, but it won't live. So I took it home. Still wasn't even out of its aesthetic. Got it out of its anaesthetic and propped it up and told it it had to live. It was only a young bird, first flight out of its nest. By that evening, I was feeding it fruit pulp. 14 days later, it was completely healed up. I had to go back to the vet and get some of the stitches removed. They were supposed to be self-dissolving, but I could tell the weight of the stitches in the crop was unbalancing it. So I said to the vet, well, let's take out the rest of these stitches. 14 days later, it was completely healed. I took it out and it flew away. They'd gathered in all their friends to see this great release. And it flew up into the trees and it sat there and it looked about and thought, well, by Joe, this is home. I've just left here 14 days ago. I better get active. Flew away. So that's just some of the little stories you get, but that's been a lifelong, apart from my tramping and climbing, and my kids, and now my grandkids, it's been a lifelong. Keep me going.
May you keep going a lot longer, Pam.
That's about it.
Thank you very much indeed.